So this is related to something I've been interested in a while, but from a kind of outside perspective. I'm not in quantum foundations per se, and that's also part of the reason why I'm giving this talk here. I want to get a feeling for if and where I'm going wrong or where I'm missing something that might be important for the community. And I tried to catch up a little bit with the literature, but I found it difficult. So feedback is welcome, but it's tentative. It's a first try at this, at these ideas. So let's start with this. I think you probably have all seen this diagram. There's Niels Bohr watching the territory between the quantum mechanics and classical mechanics. And I think this is in Zez's book or something like that. And the problem is what is allowed to cross or not, or when does something cross? And he's there to watch that out. And this is described by the classical quantum divide. And the usual issue is that the universe, as described by Psi, will evolve into a state containing many alternatives, and we don't see those alternatives, at least in the microscopic universe. So at the root of our unease is this clash between the principle of superposition, in a way, and everyday classical reality. This is one aspect of the measurement problem. And for Bohr, he thought really that the classical measuring apparatus was necessary. So let me give you a brief outline of this talk. I'm gonna really blaze through some introduction to space-time consistent histories and some of the shortcomings that, again, that at least I think they might have. Maybe these things have been overcome already, I don't know. And that's what my understanding at the moment. And then I'm gonna talk about timeless quantum dynamics and something called Jacobi or action matrix. And then I'm gonna get to the meat of it, hopefully with enough time, which is this vision of quantum mechanics in timeless or a non-relativistic configuration space. The main features, and this I'm putting this here now so that you can keep an eye out for it, or you know, at least see where I'm trying to get with these things, is that this formalism doesn't really have superpositions in a way. It will only tell you when there is interference between coarse grainies. And in that sense, it's similar to consistent histories. And the claim is that you could only see superpositions in the form of interference patterns, in a way, generalized. So there's also, I'm trying to propose a dynamical notion of locality and perhaps in a different variant context, and this is also tentative, and an operational definition of records in this context, which doesn't allow recoherence. It's basically a criterion for my types of records, which will not allow recoherence of things that have already decohered in a way. We'll see what I mean by that. And then a preferred notion of coarse grainies, which I think is one of the issues with consistent histories, from my understanding. Okay, so the first part, which is very quick, this is the usual story about decoherence, where you have some state entangling, or some pointer states and entangling with the environment, and the environment effectively diagonalizes the density matrix. For that, we've all seen that. I'm going to, again, run through that. So the consistent histories framework they try to assign probabilities to particular, let's say, past histories of an experiment. And the way that you do that is you say, okay, I can assign probabilities to past histories if, in a way, they don't interfere, if these histories don't interfere. So what do I mean by that? You have a set of orthogonal projection operators. And these orthogonal projection operators will tell you a history of your past system. So they will project an initial quantum state. And this is failing. Where's the hockey stick? So they will project a past history of your quantum state. For instance, different alpha k could be position intervals. An electron might arrive at a screen at time tk. Or they could be, for instance, oh, the electron went through the upper slit, or the electron went through the down slit, or someone decided to make a measurement, and things like that. And there are conditions that these things have to satisfy. The first conditions of these projectors are that they have to be exhaustive and they have to be exclusive. And a particular history will correspond to a sequence of these projectors. And this is so this is the history, this is the chain of projectors, and this is the example that I gave of a particular past history. And the decoherence functional is actually the measure of interference between these pairs of histories. So this is usually goes by this name. Sorry, there should be an alpha prime here. And basically you project the density matrix into these two past histories that you have defined for the system and see if this is nearly zero. So for pure initial states, this just means that I get psi alpha, which means that I projected that initial state into all this string of projectors, gotten a final state here, and I take the inner product with a different history, and I see if that is nearly zero. And then I can assign probabilities and say, oh, the electron actually did this or did that. And the path integral language, which I would prefer here in this talk, you write it in these terms. And you can really see if rho, for instance, is a delta function or something like that, then you would actually get d alpha alpha as something like, basically one kernel or one path integral times a complex conjugate of path integral restricted to go through these regions, alpha and alpha prime, if they are regions, or more generally through this string of projectors. And then, as I said, so for alpha different than alpha prime, if they're all zero, they don't really significantly interfere. So I assign probabilities to the past histories. Okay, this is the general story. There are limitations to this. And the first limitation regarding decoherence is that it requires a separation of system and environment. So many people say, oh, this is not straightforwardly applicable to the entire universe, in which you don't really do this, so for quantum cosmology. But there, from what I understand, there are also problems with microscopic description. I understand not too much about this. This is an argument that Jess Riedel was explaining to me about running out of space in Hilbert space and things like that with in the branches. So if any of you know more about this, we can talk chat later. You can explain it to me. But in any case, the consistent history aims to resolve part of this by dispensing with the separation and focusing on the interference between the different histories. But there is a remaining issue with consistent histories in that one must still choose the coarse grain sets or the histories. And this is the main thing, is that the choices have to stay within one framework. So for example, let's say I want to talk about a history of the system in a spin X, the spin X projection of a history of a spin system. I can tell a history about that, but if I try to tell simultaneously a history about the spin Y or the spin Z, these things are not going to be compatible. They're non-commuting observables, and you get actually past histories of the system which don't really, it's not unique. As long as your projectors here are unique, you can tell kind of, not unique, but okay, as long as the different consistent histories can be a refinement of a larger consistent histories in which the things propagate, you can tell a consistent story. But otherwise, you get these different frameworks and you get just incompatible past histories of the system. You don't know how to select these things. Okay, so this is the single framework rule, which is also related to the set selection problem in consistent histories. This is what I understand. Okay, so that was my brief intro to that. Another brief intro into timeless stuff. So the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, I don't know if you guys are familiar with this in quantum foundations, I think most are. is that when you do a canonical quantization of GR, when you do a Hamiltonian framework and a canonical quantization, you get an equation of this form. These are horrible operators. This is second functional derivatives at the same point. It might involve different points, but there's coincidence limits and everything. And you don't have, you notice you don't have a time derivative here, okay? So this doesn't have also positive signature, so it's not really like a Laplacian. You could try to think, oh, this is kind of like a Klein-Gordon field. What you would do with the Klein-Gordon field usually would be you interpret it classically, and then you quantize, you create, you know, annihilation creation operators, and you quantize the Klein-Gordon field. Some people call that second quantization. In this case, this won't work. You don't have, you can't separate things into positive and negative frequency, and so on. So people interpret this as a time-independent Schrodinger equation, but then, and it makes sense in a way because it's a quantization of the constraint in GR that generates different notions of time, different refoliations, okay? So the timelessness here is related to the superharmonization invariant of the theory. But okay, so suppose we do have a timeless theory. Mott, the bubble chamber experiment, he showed how to extract straight lines for alpha decay in a bubble chamber from a spherically symmetric potential. And to do that, he solved the time-independent equation and found that the solution peaked on collinear configurations of bubbles. So here is an example where you might look at something that is in a way timeless, but it tells you in the configuration itself, it tells you kind of a history of the system. It tells you, it holds records of something that might be happening, even in a timeless framework, or something that we would mistake for time or for a history. Okay, so in more generality, can we extract a notion of time from just records or subsystems? And the answer is yes, there are many different approaches to do that, even in a timeless framework. And I'm just gonna mention briefly three. This is because in the theory that I'm gonna be attacking, it is timeless, but it's also susceptible to extracting time in different forms, okay? So there's a notion of internal time, for instance, argued that global reparamerization invariants should not be associated with a gauge freedom. These are some arguments by Barber and Kukash. But it's also related to setting one of the variables to be a hidden time. Okay, so you parameterize relational aspects of your theory. You say, look, we always relate what is happening here with the density of a scalar field. You have some dust field that tells you what time it is, but only relationally, okay? This is the internal time. You have a notion of emergent time in which you can do a Born-Oppenheimer approximation and use some heavy fields to tell you how the rest of the fields are evolving with respect to these heavy fields. And this is, I'm gonna be focusing more on timeless at face value, okay? And this is, you really need to supplant becoming with being in a philosophical way, in more philosophy-based. So history or dynamics here is our apparent notions constructed from the instant, more in line, for instance, with the Mott experiment. Okay. And let me just give you a quick example of how to extract timeful from timeless. And this is basically, you have a relational reparametrization invariant model, which is called the Barber-Bertotti model, which is just, this, you can see it's reparametrization invariant because it's homogeneous in lambda. And so if you have any kinetic potential energy, you find an equations of motion which has a complicated form, but then you recover the usual Newtonian equations of motion by using what they call ephemeris time, so a particular notion of time, which is basically parametrizing this theory, which defines basically just reparametrization invariant line elements in your configuration space, and you define some particular arc length parameterization for these things. And this arc length parameterization for these curves or for these geodesics corresponds to basically Newtonian time and Newtonian equations of motion. And then you recover, when you institute that, you recover the usual Newtonian equations of motion from the Barber-Bertotti action. So, okay, so this is just an example, but it serves to represent something deeper that I want to say, is that you can, in many cases, well, usually, in most cases, when you have an action, and this is here is given by a positive definite, the kinetic energy has a positive definite metric. Okay, so it, for instance, so the way that you multiply velocities together is by using a positive definite metric. Okay, if you have something like these and these things are smooth, then you can actually find an equivalent system for which the extremal actions of these things are just geodesics of a conformally related metric. So you, G is the metric that I'm using in the kinetic energy here. And if I just look at a metric, a conformally related metric to G, like this in this configuration space, okay, I can see that geodesics with respect to this conformally related metric are actually the extremal paths of that action. Okay, so this is I can view dynamics as geodesic motion in an associated configuration space. And I'm gonna assume for most of the talk that that you can look at this geometric this geometric composition here. And I'll call this the action metric. There are cases in which you can't do that, and I'll talk a little bit about that. So for example, just so in gravity even, you have something similar to the Barber-Bertotti and Newtonian, which is called the Barlain-Sharpe-Wheeler action. You can see it has a form similar to that. The problem here is you have an integral, the square root is, in the other case you'd had a sum here, here you have an integral outside, but I'm not gonna get much into that. And you also extract the local experience time. It's given by this form of the lattice. It's basically you take the kinetic energy of the metric. T is the kinetic energy of the metric in a way, and you have an inertial mass, let's say, which is kind of like the R, the Ricci scalar. Anyways, there are problems with the geometric interpretation of this because the width metric is not Riemannian. The conformal modes have negative norm, but there are gravitational models for which this is not an issue. Okay, so let's just keep that in mind that what I'm doing here might be applicable to all fields, at least in some models. Okay, so now finally, let's get to the meat of the talk. So first, I wanted to cite this so that I can, you know, open your minds to configuration space and see its virtues. So I think everybody does, but at least I much prefer it. So Feynman says that, look, all measurements of quantum mechanical systems could be made to reduce eventually to position and time measurements. So he just says, okay, we can use this formulation in terms of configuration space to describe all phenomena. And I would add that even the reading of a clock is abstracted from a position measurement. It's a relational thing that we can, in this internal time respect, it's an internal relation between different things in the same configuration. Okay, so I will include clocks in the configuration or time or things like that if they have it, if I have it in the theory. Okay, so now, these are my principles. If you don't like them, I have others, I forgot who said that. But anyways, so I will start with saying that I have a closed universe, and for me this will be representing a spatial manifold. Okay, I'm thinking of this really non-relativistic framework that we work in some models of gravity, like shape dynamics, Rojava, some models of gravity, you have this particular thing. And I will look at, so let's have an antipole of fields there. So these are all like vector fields, even the metric is a tensor field, but it's a section on a tensor bundle. So I will look at configuration space M for the antipole of fields and the space of all possible spatial field configurations phi over this spatial manifold, over this manifold M. So the space of sections of tensor bundles over this. And then the main object, that I will look at is a path integral kernel given some action for these fields. It should be repermanentization invariant action. I mean, this is something that probably can be discussed. And I'll also start with a further postulate here, which is the vacuum. Okay, so I will say, look, there is a preferred point in any of these tensor bundles, even in gravity, or any section over a vector bundle, which is the zero configuration. So this means that all fields are zero. The electric field is zero, and the gravitational field is zero. If the gravitational field is zero, not Euclidean, that means that geometrically you have contracted your space to a point. Okay, so the metric topology is structureless. There are no distances.
Why would you define that as a vacuum? Why would you define flat space as a vacuum?
Why wouldn't I define flat space?
Yeah, that just seems like a more natural characterization.
No, not really. I mean, so for instance, in loop quantum gravity, people also have, Bianca is working with a vacuum that is completely structureless, and I want something that is nothing. I want a universe from nothing, in a way. Well, in this case, I'm not talking about energy or anything like that. I'm just thinking about configurations, and I could define other points with a lot of symmetry that have these configurations have a lot of symmetry. But this one is singled out in a way, like if you want, even mathematically. No.
So that metric where non-zero would be just Euclidean.
That's right. So did I say Minkowski? I meant Euclidean or flat, yeah.
No, you said that.
Okay. Yes. So, yeah, it really is nothing. Not a vacuum, it's really nothing. Okay. And on top of this thing, I'm going to define some density, okay, on top of configuration space. Remember, there's no time here. Time, if anything, is included in the configuration variables. And I'm going to define some density. And so let's call that the zero section zero. I'm going to define a density distribution over the configuration space as basically the Born rule, okay? But I'm going to tell you why I define it like this in one slide. So this picture, so for now, let's just take stock a little bit. For now, what I mean by this is that this picture entails that all configurations and all instantaneous states and observers and everything in it, they actually exist. Okay, the configurations, the space of all possible universes there exists, and it has a frozen density distribution over it, which is given by this. It's just a density over the space of existence or something like that, over configuration space. Okay? And you have this density, this density, of course, is more concentrated in some places, in others it's less concentrated. Okay? And I'm calling this the Born rule. And what I will use this with for is compare relative volumes of configurations and also observers. I will tell you specifically in which context I will compare relative volumes of observers. So you just here integrated. This is just a measure on this vector space, and these are the densities. And I integrated and I compare. But no, this shouldn't be the volume really. I should have said this is the total number of observers, it's better. Or in a way, it's a relative number of observers. Or relative observers only if each one of these configurations contains observers. But I don't care, I don't make a distinction between observers and non-observers. They're all parts of the fields that I have.
Let me try to understand. So you say all configurations exist. And there's a measure. They're concentrated.
That's right.
But what does that mean? If they all exist, then they all exist. What is the physical interpretation of this concentration?
Well, it's so this is a continuous infinite dimensional space, right? So you can't count it like this. You have to integrate it over. You have to find, you know, any meaning of how many observers there are. You need to do some integration. You need a measure.
So you suddenly started talking about numbers of observers.
Yes.
I didn't see where that came in.
OK, so you're right. I should have. What I meant by this is just that I put in the number of observers here so that you start thinking about these fields as actually also these configurations as containing possibly observers as well. Okay, observers will be particular configurations of these fields, and they will be related to certain regions of this configuration space where you have these types of configurations of the fields. And I will calculate volumes of this density function. I'll calculate not volumes, so total numbers of these configurations, let's say, in certain areas and compare them.
Am I to think of the universe as having been generated by sampling from this measure a particular configuration, which is the timeless universe, and your theory is corroborated if that measure makes the things that we observe highly probable? Is that the idea? So you're imagining that the universe is really one configuration, and it's sampled from this distribution?
No.
No.
Okay. I'm imagining that it's a multiverse idea. This is some version of many worlds.
Okay, so now what do I think of the measure? It's usually I would say the measure constant, the relative probability of actuality being this phi, not that phi. And now all the phis exist, so the measure is?
So the measure is a density of over the space of configurations. So how am I going to integrate over certain regions? Of how am I going to count configurations, basically? Right, because you need a way to count these configurations.
I see. So it's just a question of, roughly speaking, the number of universes in your multiverse of a particular sort.
Yes. And I will take ratios between, and you'll see, it will become more clear what I mean by this when you take ratios of configurations that have the same records. That's going to be the main thing that I'm going
to.
You see, yeah. I mean, yes, that's the concept of interference comes from that, basically. Okay, so let me move on. We still have 10 more slides to go. So for extremal paths, you can also derive a semi-classical approximation, which is written like this. This is called the Van Vleck determinant. Okay, and this is the on-shell action. So it's let's suppose you have many classical paths, usually between an initial and a final configuration. And you have one Van Vleck determinant for each one of these, and one on-shell classical action for each one of these. And well, you can write it like this, and you can take the norm and split it, and you have a term that looks like an interference term, and a term that is not an interference term. And so let me just define, this is gonna be very important for us. The Van Vleck determinant is the determinant of the second functional variation of the on-shell action in terms of its initial and final configurations, okay? So the interpretation of this, if you write it so the variation of the on-shell action by, for instance, the initial configuration gives you the initial momenta, and the interpretation of this, if you look at it this way, is the inverse of how the final configurations vary with respect to differing momenta, initial momenta. So it basically tells you how how classical trajectories, if you have some region here and you go like this with one momenta, but at slightly different momenta, you vary very rapidly, okay? That means that the Van Vleck determinant is very small, okay? And if it focuses trajectories, then the Van Vleck determinant gets bigger, okay? The classical trajectories. And these things are related to Lyapunov exponents. So, okay. Now, why will I use this? Because I want my interpretation of observers to have some classical grounding, to have this classical anchor. Or why have I chosen the Born rule? Basically, this is this slide. And is if I choose two distinct final configurations, let's suppose I still have the same initial configuration, then the classically propagated relative densities of configurations d rho 1 over d rho 2, it gives me, you can write this out, but it's not hard to see, that gives me the ratio of the von Vleck determinants. Okay? And this is the case, the classical case that I want here, is the case where the semi-classical kernel has no interference terms. So there's just one classical trajectory between an initial and a final point. Yeah, there are no quantum effects. And this is equal, in this case, in which you have the semi-classical kernel has no interference terms, this is equal to the ratio between the two propagators. Here we can see it's if there are no ones, they're just equivalent to this. So you have also a ratio here. And so this is the property that my density has to obey in that limit. So any density that I choose, and I will choose a density that only depends on the amplitude kernel on that point, okay? Because I'm telling you that this is all the only object that I have is how the amplitude kernel will define an amplitude at a given configuration coming from my vacuum. So how it will materialize a particular configuration coming from the vacuum or the density of it. And the Born rule that I chose is a natural extension of this classical property for a functional that only depends on this. I don't know if it's the unique one, but this is one justification for having chosen the Born rule in this case. Okay. So now I also have a coarse graining in my configuration space. And for that, I have a bundle of paths around a given curve. This is the space of curves between an initial and a final configuration. And they're contained in some open set around gamma, okay? And I can call that a bundle of paths. There's some open set of around each, actually, yeah. So here you'll see a set of coarse grained histories that I define between two configurations. Again, I'll have exclusive and exhaustive to order epsilon, not to absolute order. If they don't share elements, so they can have the curves that, so here I'm defining an initial and a final point, and I have some coarse grained history, which is kind of like an open bundle of paths. And this is another one, and so on, and they can intersect, but they don't share paths. And the definition there, epsilon exhaustive to order epsilon, if the total amplitude kernel between phi I and phi f, it's reproduced by basically restricting these things up to some order epsilon. So basically by the path integral restricted to d space, plus the path integral restricted to the space, and so on, plus some order epsilon. So the total transition amplitude is approximated by this. Okay, so what is my notion of decoherence here? Is that a sufficient condition for, as we saw, for d alpha alpha prime equals zero, is that the individual contribution from either coarse graining set is approximately zero. So here I'm looking at a particular case where you have a pure state, initial pure state, and then it's basically, if I call the amplitude here k alpha and here k alpha prime, then the decoherence functional between alpha and alpha prime in this case is basically k alpha prime dagger, or well, in this case it's just complex conjugate, and. So I'll say that in this context, I'll say rather that different coarse grainings fade with respect to each other, in the sense that if discourse graining really doesn't contribute here, it's really something that is, you know, it can be, there's a lot of dephasing or whatever, it doesn't really contribute, then it fades with respect to the other one. It just means that if you take the norm with one amplitude here divided by the other, it's a very small number. And a strong interference will occur for cross-grain histories that do not fade, that both are kind of like the same strength and they reach the things. This is, I mean, it, again, it's not a sufficient condition, okay? But in my case, this is what I want. Fading is a more important concept. Okay, so now, but I don't want to have just any coarse graining. I don't want to have any coarse graining like this because, well, we have the same problem, not the same problem as before, but there's just too many of these. And and it's hard to say, for instance, if what is the physical meaning attached to them in a way. And I wanna use the structure of my configuration space and the structure of my action to choose preferred coarse grainings. Okay, so the idea is to use extremal paths in configuration space to define my coarse grainings. And in a Riemannian geometry, at least, since I'm using this action metric, you have the Hopf-Reynolds theorem that says for a complete smooth Riemannian manifold, two points are geodesically connected. Okay. The problem is that usually the potential term is not smooth, and there are, you know, you have delta potentials and things like that. And Hopf-Reynolds, you can't even a priori, you wouldn't even be able to translate this into an action metric. But actually, Marsden has shown that you can, and you also get still something like Hopf-Reynolds, but now you don't necessarily go from any point to any other point by a single smooth path. You might have to have a corner and then go there, okay? So this is what I call like piecewise smooth paths. And also, so there's an alternative path integral expansion to all orders in H-bar with higher derivatives of the on-shell action around these piecewise extremal paths. And this is Cecile DeWitt and also in the infinite dimensional case shortly thereafter. This is just to say that, look, I haven't worked out these things in full generality, but the mathematical structure exists to expand the definitions that I'm going to show you into the more general cases. Okay, and even? Yeah, so that's a good question because he's asking this because in GR, when you take the quotient by the diffeomorphisms, or yeah, you have a stratified manifold, which are manifolds that have barriers. This would work there. Yeah, these work like kind of delta potentials where you might have kinks in this geodesics. Okay. And then I define this piecewise extremal coarse graining, okay? So I give phi I and phi f. Let's say there is just a single, but that phi I and phi f are connected by extremal paths in this action metric. And then I just define this my preferred coarse grainings as being centered around these extremal paths, okay? And I can say, okay, so let's suppose a double slit experiment. I have a double slit experiment. I have some, let's say, a shutter or something like that, and I look at my final point, or a final point here x, and there are basically two. Well, it's not true because here let's suppose I have a time shutter here, or even if I don't. I have basically two classes of paths that reach there, and these are extremal paths, or at least piecewise extremal. And then I'm gonna define basically a radius over each point like this. And any path, and all these paths that are contained in this radius define for me the preferred coarse grainings, okay? And in the semi-classical amplitude, if I have classical paths that connect an initial final configuration or extremal paths, I know that this is exhaustive up to order h squared. Okay. And okay. So So this is my definition, and I can extend this again to piecewise extremal paths. The problem is the problem is here that I define this R naught or this radius here of these preferred coarse grainings with respect to just to the action metric. What you really want is to define it with respect to some amplitude distance. Say, look, you don't really need to consider that point because it really has no interference in your system. And so this does work, for instance, for a generic or chaotic system where the von Vleck decreases with the action distance. So the longer that you go, the von Vleck will fan out and it will decrease. So they are related, at least in most cases. So there is something to be worked out here about relating this the width of this coarse graining with some amplitude distance. Okay. And so this is a slide that is a bit tentative, or it's a notion that I want to define for my systems of semi-classical locality. Okay. So here I don't have time. I don't have a space-time structure. And I still want to say something about when I can consider just one system separately from the other or not. Well, the answer is almost always, but here what I really want is to get something similar to a cluster decomposition, okay, or a semi-classical cluster decomposition. And the idea is to get, I know the answer, okay? The answer is I want my von Vleck determinants to diagonalize, to become diagonal for each of the regions. So that for when O is different than OJ, it's zero. So because then I can separate my semi-classical amplitude I can factorize my semi-classical amplitude. And this happens when the final momenta at a region OJ that I have does not depend on the initial configuration of fields. You can have the inverse of this. But anyways, when these things are independent. And this is for the decoupled regions. And the way that I define this is I say, look, imagine I have two regions, O and O prime here. Forget a little bit about the diffeomorphisms, how they're acting, O and O prime. And I have an initial configuration of the whole system, phi I or phi zero. And I have another configuration at regions O and O prime, phi I. And I'm saying, look, any classical field history that if I just look at O or prime, if I look at any classical field history at O or prime, then I can find a classical field history of the whole thing of N, of big N, right, or phi naught, such that when you restrict the solution of the whole thing to O and O prime, or at least to regions diffeomorphic to O and O prime, because here I have to take an infimum over time dependent diffeomorphisms, that this norm of these things is very small. So basically what you want to think about is, look, I had some initial conditions here. I have many classical paths that go to this final one. And I also have many classical paths that go to this final one. But in fact, any combination that I take can be embedded in one classical solution of the whole thing, or can be at least closely embedded. Because otherwise, if I can't do this, then it means that I have to always take them as a pair. I can only take this one with some other one, let's say, and so on and so forth, so that they're not independent, Okay, so this would be my criterion for that. It's a criterion that doesn't that I think doesn't depend on the space-time structure and doesn't you only need to know what are your solutions basically. You don't need, even need to know what your action is, if it's local or non-local, in a way. I mean, it's a first try at least. And what you do get is that you get a semi-classical cluster decomposition because your semi-classical amplitude decomposes like this over the two regions. Here I just took for simplicity O and the complement of O. Of course, it's never gonna be perfect, right? Because you have things coming in from the boundaries and all of that. There might be some influence, but I can bound, the issue is that you can bound this semi-classical locality by this epsilon. So I don't know, let's see. But what I want, I get, of course, because it's kind of reverse engineered anyways, which is this decomposition. Okay, now, another tentative thing is semi-classical records. What do I mean by semi-classical records? Here they're similar to projection operators in the consistent histories, but I want all of the histories to basically, all the histories of a certain process in a single framework, let's say, to have the same projector operator at some point. And this is, would be the analogous thing here, what I'm calling a record. Okay, so I will say that a field configuration phi contains a semi-classical record of phi r if all the extremal coarse grainings between the zero and that point have to pass through this phi r record. So what I'm saying is I start here with the zero configuration and I have some configuration here which I call the record configuration, and I have phi. Phi contains a record of phi r if the extremal ones have to pass, or you know, or they have to at least include phi r. Okay? And note that this is a property of phi. Okay, it's so the way to think about this is, let's say you have a configuration here and we set up an experiment. Okay, what we are doing when we run an experiment, if we only have access to the now, let's say, is we remember that we have set up this experiment. We have this record of configuration in our memories and in other things. There's, in some way, we have embedded this phi r or some aspects of this recorded configuration into phi. Okay, and I want to say that how do I do this in a timeless manner? Basically, that's my challenge here, because I want to do it in a path integral manner, which that it's only reliant really on time in this through the path integral or through amplitudes and things like that. So I mean, I could have just, this does, for instance, if I wanted to go explicitly to the classical limit, I could just have, if there's, for instance, just one single classical one, then any point along this classical trajectory will be a record of that final one. Okay, but this is a generalization of it to these instances. And what I get when this happens is that the amplitude also factorizes for the amplitude between zero and that record that you have, and that record in this moment. And this is important because now I can forget about what has actually happened before the record, or at least to some approximate thing. Because if I'm just taking ratios, let's do the electron. I just want to say we're here right now. All the copies of us in configuration space are here with the same record, which is the setup of an experiment, let's say the double slit experiment or any experiment, and we're in the submanifold here. Oops. And we're in the submanifold here, and we all have this thing. We don't know where we are. There's a certain distribution over us, a certain density over this manifold. And we have, this is all a manifold of R, or of the recorded manifold. And then what you do is you compare how many, basically, if you do this many times or anything like that, you compare how many copies of you are have a certain outcome given that record, given that that same record. Or and to do, and this is a comparison here, basically, of the of this. Well, this is the comparison of the amplitude. But it, the important thing is that it factors out, and you can compare just looking at previous records. Yeah, that's the notion that I have of records here. I'd like to compare with more standard definitions of records, but it's I haven't been able to so far. That's the definition of records that I have. Okay. And it really gives you this, okay, how many copies of an observer or of certain of the electron hitting point XY are there compared to how many copies of fields where the electron hit a different position. Okay, and you don't need to know the entire history of the universe for that. Okay, so now we're in the discussions. And an application to gravity is not straightforward in for normal, so for relativistic descriptions, because if you have the problem with theories that have refoliation invariance is that they don't really, if you go down to it, if you boil it down, is that the actions of the constraints don't have a projection into configuration space. So basically, if you have a path that looks like this in configuration space, and if you perform a refoliation, it can change drastically. So two paths that might have intersected before in a different foliation don't intersect anymore, basically because you're changing the notion of the spatial metric or of what the instant is. Okay. So it does, at least fundamentally, it does require a preferred notion of simultaneity to work in the simple form. And but Lorentz invariance is recoverable in many ways. One of the ways that I haven't really mentioned is that observers, if we only have knowledge of a finite region of our field here, you don't really determine a single point in configuration space. You determine a whole submanifold in configuration space of all the configurations that are compatible with your configuration in this area. So you just determine a whole configuration space, and then you might get that doing refoliations outside of this area actually are always obliged to intersect and things like that. This is something new that I've been thinking about. But anyways. And we have gravitationally induced decoherence. There's nothing special about gravitationally induced decoherence here. It's just paths that or coarse grainings that don't interfere in a that they don't strongly interfere anymore, and they're just histories of your dynamical system that don't have high amplitudes associated to them. So, for instance, let's suppose for one system I have some history like this, and this is the final configuration, and then I had one that would have reached there, but then I have some interaction here or something like that. That let's suppose in the double slit experiment, I have some interaction here that tags one of the electrons, that paints it blue or whatever, and this is painted red. Then it's going to diverge. It's at least the classical path won't come to that configuration anymore, and won't interfere with the other thing. That's why I don't have interference here. Of course, there is a path in which this electron spontaneously turns red again, but that will have a very small amplitude associated to it. So the interference fades. That's what I meant by that. So there's an interesting calculation that I wanted to do for a simplified model, which is Gooding and Unruh, in which they try to find basically a self-gravitating interferometry for shells of matter. You have a shell of matter that goes through basically a half mirror or something like that, continues to expand, rebounds, and the other one does the same thing going inwards in GR, and you try to find out if there are interference terms, basically. Okay. And the heuristic emerging picture is similar to Everett Wheeler, but here all points in configuration space simultaneously exist. Of course, this is, again, you need an integration measure. Each configuration itself is completely classical, okay? The quantum character that we see is felt by interference. Here, there is no meaning to say that, look, you have you would be seeing, in a way, two microscopic kittens, because your brain state is as much part of the configuration as any microscopic anything. Okay, what you observe is interference between alternative paths reaching a final configuration. And yeah, that's what I've just said, that it has really no meaning. And so...
I don't follow you.
Yeah.
First of all, I was wondering what the connection was to your earlier point about position, the configuration space of positions being important, because you're dealing with the configuration space of metrics.
That's right.
So now you're back to positions of particles in the world.
Well, I wasn't dealing just with configuration space of metrics. I was saying there are any n fields in this configuration space. And if we are any, and we ourselves are formed by certain compositions of these fields.
Right, but I don't think anybody thinks that a complete physical description of a brain is just the configuration of a brain. If you leave out all the velocities, you leave out, you can't tell if a person's alive or dead.
No, I mean, this would be a snapshot of the brain, right?
Right, but you can't. And,
Sorry, I didn't understand. What constitutes an observation? I didn't understand that point.
Well, why are you talking about the brain all of a sudden in the snapshot?
Well, yeah, okay. So here, I just want...
It has something to do with observation.
Yeah, but this is just to get the point across. So we can get the impression of velocity or of speed. I mean, if you look at trajectories in configuration space or how things get to a certain configuration, and if you look at the classical trajectories, we would have the impression, we would make correlations and say that really happened and that came from there to here. But in fact, this existed here. Our impression is just because the amplitudes of a path integral would be concentrated along certain paths in this picture. You can extract a notion of time from this. And this was the point of all these things of internal time and other notions of time and things like that.
Okay, so go on. Yeah, I'll try to process that as you go.
Okay, yeah. And so I tried to introduce a dynamical notion of locality and a definition of record that this allows recoherence, because recoherence, usually people were worried about, at least people like Daniel Sudarsky, saying, look, if you have a branching multiverse, what tells you that you have something like here that branched, and you say, oh, decohered, whatever, but you have nothing to say that this will come back and bite you. And here, this is basically my definition of record, is disallowing this kind of recoherence. Again, I need to connect this notion of record to something more physical, because for now it's just a prescription of something that my semi-classical amplitude, a way that my semi-classical amplitude is behaving. And yeah, so that's it. Thank you. And I want to thank some people for our discussions. And yeah, thank you. Sure. So, for instance, I mean, okay, look, if I really include gravity, then no, I can't. But no, but I can look at something that falls into this picture is, for example, the Barber-Bertotti model. Then I can recover semi-classical Newtonian.
No, but I mean, quantitative results for interference. So, for
yeah.
Example,
Yeah, sure, that's what I mean. You would recover exactly part normal, you know, particle quantum mechanics for the Barber-Bertotti model, at least in the semi-classical model, you recover interference, right? It's just, it's how you... So I have here one example, and well, it's basically the example that I gave you of the consistent histories. But I mean, there are no calculations here. I didn't include, this calculation I can show you using the Barber-Bertotti model, how you recover interference patterns. But it's, if you just, interference patterns is just, you have to find what are your classical solutions, right? And you have to look at what happens with this term here. And you can find out, I mean, for simple models, you can calculate what are your you can basically solve your Hamilton-Jacobi equation, and you can calculate what are these terms, and you find how different classical paths interfere, and you get these interference terms.
And then you get interference, it must really be coming from this measure that you put on this.
That's right. So the measure is given by this, right?
That space itself is just a classical space, the configuration space.
The configuration space, yes, it is
just
a classical space, that's right.
You put a particular measure on that.
That's right.
And
in some points, for instance, where the measure is zero, let's say, it's a let's suppose you have an interference pattern in a double slit experiment, and there's one of the fringes, a point where very few electrons hit, right? This is this line here, it's not exactly this, but. What would happen is that that you would not find yourself in a configuration where these things, where or you would find would be very difficult to find yourself in a configuration where an electron ended up here, because the measure in the configuration space for those points is very, very small, or it's very sparsely distributed there. This measure. Yeah. Yeah, so I
do have a quantum state inside that space that evolves unitarily.
That's right.
And then you have arguments to try and show that the measure psi squared is the right measure.
That's right.
Whereas here you have a classical.
That's right.
Your space is a classical configuration space.
That's right.
And your measure is the one that you told us.
Yes. I can recover if I define one of my coordinates, for example. Let's suppose I can define an internal variable as time. If I do that in configuration space, I can find a time-dependent Schrödinger equation that tells me how this distribution varies as I increase or decrease this coordinate. Right. This is, for instance, in the. Oh no! Wait. This is up. Anyways, this is, for instance, any one of these, for instance, for the Born-Oppenheimer, I can recover these kind of things. But this is just basically selecting one of your configuration variables or combination or something like that to parameterize the evolution of your wave function.
So here it's not so clear because you can start with classical.
So for instance, a tunneling would be something that you.
Entanglement.
Oh, entanglement. Yeah. Oh. So entanglement is exactly this, right? Suppose you have. You don't know where. You have two particles, you don't know they're entangled, you don't know where they're going, but you know that their states will be correlated. Okay? So you have, let's suppose, this is the whole configuration. So it contains the two particles. And it can go in many different directions, but it contains the two particles in that same configuration. So you can find yourself in one of these things, in one of these configurations. And if you look at one particle, it will always be correlated with the other. You don't know which one you're at, so it's still. Because you don't have a single one. You don't have a single one. You have all possible ones, or in the same way that you don't know where you are in this. It's not like it has a state and you just don't, and you have to look at it to see where it is. You are at, it has all these states. And that's right. It has all these states with this measure.
The fact that the particles are entangled would be included in the record.
Yes, that's right. Yes.
This thing on the records reminds me of Bayes.
Yeah.
It's like a prior.
Yes, that's right.
You're comparing. But then, on the other hand, this approach looks quite far away from subjective.
That's right. So it's a mixture. Yeah. So that's what I mean. It's a mixture of all these things, like, you know, ontic and subjective, because there is a notion in which records we compare things that with the same records. So there's a notion of this subjectivism in a way, but in another way. The actual whole configuration space exists, so there is some real ontology beneath it.
But your rule of the inference is something that we abstracted from our experience, which means that it's something that is written in our record.
Yes.
There is sort of.
There is, you know. Yeah. Some circularity, yes.
Yeah, some circularity.
That's right.
I don't know, I guess.
Yes, that's right.
So I'm not clear that whatever the equivalent of a state is here, is it dictated by the dynamics?
What?
Is that
what do you, so?
Question,
so. No. Sure. So that's the difficulty here is that if I wanted to be completely honest, I would say, look, the whole of configuration space has only one state, right? The issue is that you find it's relative. It's relative partial states that you compare. So it's relative when you compare relative distributions in these places, or how the amplitude has reached here with here with the same records, that you can define more. You can kind of fine grain what you mean by some relative state.
So what is the state then of the whole configuration?
So if you wanted to yeah. So okay. So if I wanted to tell you what if I wanted to write it in terms of Bras and Katz, I would write it like this. I would write, this is now an, kind of an operator that parallel propagates from the zero. So zero, I have a unique state that I'm defining. This is, it's a one-dimensional Hilbert space over each configuration. And then I have, I mean, all the paths, but the path integral, what defines my state here would be through this I mean, this would define morphisms and things like that, but what would define my phi here would be the amplitude kernel that takes me from there to there. And this would define me the state over each configuration in a way. And then you have to play around with relations between states, basically.
That's
yes. Okay. All right, thank you.